At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Who are you going to believe about the economy? Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve or the numbers? Bernanke and the gang will tell you they're still worried about inflation. The numbers, though, might paint a blurrier picture based on reports out today and a big one coming tomorrow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here today. It's Thursday, the 6th of September. We'll pick just a couple of statistics to get things going, because really much of what the economic news will be over the next 10 days is going to depend on a number we'll get tomorrow morning, the August unemployment report. As we wait, though, here's some context. We learned this morning worker productivity rose at its fastest rate in nearly 2 years, and the growth in labor costs slowed. If we could get Mr. Bernanke on the phone right about now, he'd say that's a good thing inflation-wise. Also, major retailers said today August sales were strong, something sure to please economists. But there are some items on the negative side of the ledger, too. The Mortgage Bankers Association says a record number of homes entered foreclosure in the second quarter. That's the third quarter in a row there's been a new record for that. And oil traded above $77 today. The United States is the world's biggest energy user. China's a close second. They're also the world's biggest air polluters. A report out today looks at what the two countries can learn from each other about how to clean up that pollution or to prevent it in the first place. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
The collaboration between U.S. and Chinese scientists compared air pollution and cleanup in Los Angeles and Pittsburgh with the Chinese cities of Dalian and Huainan. It found that air pollution in China is worse than even our most polluted metro areas. But it's easy to forget that just a few decades ago, the opposite was true.
Midday in Pittsburgh, you couldn't even see the headlights on the vehicles.
That's John Watson with the Desert Research Institute, the study's lead author. He says the two countries can learn from each other's pollution mistakes, and parallels remain. Both, he says, estimate that pollution control and cleanup will cost a lot more money than they actually end up costing. And he thinks he knows why.
Because people don't want to do it. They want to throw roadblocks in the way. I think there's a reticence to spend any money, and so there's a tendency to try to put the numbers higher than they actually turn out to be.
The report found that pollution control is expensive in both countries, but far less than the cost of doing nothing. That adds up to billions in crop damage, healthcare expenses, and lost productivity. Frank O'Donnell with Clean Air Watch fears China's on the road to repeating many of our pollution mistakes, beginning with lax reporting.
They don't even measure the pollutants that are the biggest problems in the United States, smog or ozone and fine particle matter.
On the other hand, scientists say China may have an easier time implementing new technologies. That's because China is not bogged down by the democratic process or resistance from utilities. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You might not immediately think of them this way, but honeybees are one of the most important livestock breeds we have. Bees pollinate crops worth billions of dollars, but there's a problem. Colonies that commercial beekeepers truck around the country to pollinate apples and almonds and blueberries have been disappearing. Today, scientists fingered a virus that may be a cause of what's called colony collapse disorder. And as it happens, we have exactly the right reporter for that story, our resident beekeeper from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer.
Listen. That's the sound of the two beehives on my back deck. Hobby beekeepers like me haven't faced colony collapse disorder. Experts think commercial hives may be more stressed because they're frequently on the move. Columbia University's Ian Lipkin has applied classic disease-finding techniques to the problem. He's used genome analysis to pinpoint differences between hives where the bees had vanished and healthy hives.
The only agent that stood out as being different between the two was a virus recently described called IAPV, or Israel Acute Paralysis Virus.
Lipkin says IAPV probably isn't the only cause. It may be just another stressor, along with varroa mites, diseases, and the chemicals that treat them. He says it's like people with HIV. They get sick with infections that don't affect those with healthy immune systems. Even if this virus is a cause, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's honeybee expert Jeff Pettis says there's no medicine for it.
The better route is to maintain healthy colonies and or look for colonies that have natural resistance.
Fortunately, there seem to be some resistant colonies already in Israel. Pettis says without bees pollinating our fruits, we'd have a very boring diet. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Five of the top 25 compact discs on Amazon.com today feature Luciano Pavarotti. He died early this morning in Italy, as you probably heard by now. Pavarotti was an opera star for 40 years, and along the way, he helped change the business of classical music. Fred Child hosts Public Radio's classical music program, Performance Today. Hi, Fred.
Hello, Kai.
Clearly, Pavarotti was a great talent, but he was also greatly criticized, especially, I guess, later in life, for having kind of commercialized opera to a great extent. Do you think that's a fair charge? Does it stick?
You know, there was a real tough balance there. And you're right. In his prime, there was nobody better. That silky, smooth, rich sound, the incredible emotion that came through in his voice. But after about 1990, he became a mainstream superstar. And the fact is, he reveled in being a celebrity and almost became a caricature of himself. And he sang with quite a few artists who were, frankly, below his artistic level. Now, I know that's a subjective judgment, but should the greatest operatic voice of the last three or four generations have sung with the Spice Girls? You tell me, Kai.
Is he the reason why we now have people like Andrea Bocelli and the three Irish tenors in the record store?
Yeah, he opened up this marketplace, or what was perceived to be a marketplace, for a lot of other folks. It's almost impossible ever in the history of classical music to have a big classical hit. Only 25 classical recordings in the history of recordings have sold more than a million. But when the three tenors came along in 1990, Pavarotti alongside Placido Domingo and Jose Carreras, that recording turned out to be the best-selling classical recording of all time, more than 10 million copies sold. And that really changed the nature of the record business, Kai. It was like blockbuster mentality came in. Suddenly, everybody in the classical music business was saying, well, where's the next three tenors?
Is there anybody, do you think, Fred, who can take his place? Has opera lost something financially that it might never get back?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He had a mass appeal that I don't think will be matched for generations. There was a kind of directness in the emotion of his voice that came through. You didn't have to see his acting. You just had to hear his voice. And there was such vulnerability and humanity simply in the sound of his voice. And people related to that. A lot of other singers in the world of classical music and kind of on the borders of classical music have tried to duplicate that. But not everybody has the God-given gift of the voice that Pavarotti had.
Fred Child is the host of American Public Media's classical music program, Performance Today. Fred, thanks a lot.
Glad to join you, Kai.
It'll be the happy music after the day that was on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. No matter what you've heard about what the Fed might do in a couple of weeks, it's not always a good thing when a central bank cuts interest rates. Yes, it makes money cheaper, but when those rates are cut, it usually means an economy's in trouble. And in the world of interest rate perception, sometimes a non-decision is as telling as an actual cut. Today, the European Central Bank decided to keep its benchmark interest rate on hold at 4%. Expectations had been that it would rise. The non-move is making bankers and investors anxious that this fall might be worse than the summer was. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Throughout the stock market turmoil last month, optimists clung to a comforting notion. This is August, they told themselves. The heavy hitters in the banks and on the trading floors are on vacation. The juniors left in charge have panicked. Come September, everything will be fine. Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank doesn't buy that rosy scenario.
Now the big boys are back from the beach, everything's okay again. Not a chance. I think probably we've passed through the eye of the storm and we've got a lot more to come, and I don't think that any of it is going to be very good.
Also with his weather eye open is fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart of Seven Investment. In fact, he's battening down the hatches.
We're now entering the autumn, and this isn't just the season for meteorological storms. Traditionally, it's also the season for financial ones as well. So be prepared, I think, for some turbulence over the next few months.
The main worry, as ever, is the credit market. Investors that lost a bundle buying American subprime mortgages, sliced, diced and repackaged, are not overly keen to repeat the process. They're not buying debt. Weighed down with loans that they cannot offload, the banks are growing reluctant to lend, even to each other. Julian Jessop of Capital Economics.
It's all very well for them not to be willing to lend to less creditworthy investors, perhaps at the fringes of the subprime market. But if the big Wall Street banks don't trust each other, then there's clearly a global problem for us all to think about.
So far, says Andrew Hilton, the central banks, most notably the Fed, have contained the crisis by saturating the interbank money market with liquidity. The ECB pumped a further $57 billion in today.
They poured huge amounts of money into the market to make it all appear better, to buy us a few more weeks. But really, there's an underlying problem.
And that is $500 billion worth of loans that the banks cannot get off their books, hence their reluctance to lend. In spite of the general gloom, however, there are some optimists around, like Anatole Kolecki, chief economics commentator of the London Times.
I don't think we're out of the woods yet, but I think it's also very premature to assume that this will continue for more than another few weeks, given the huge amount of effort and the huge amount of money, really, that is being poured into solving it right now.
So far, the crisis has been mainly financial. The biggest European casualties, a couple of small German banks that collapsed. But the worry is that the fear will seep into the world's most important economy, the US, and turn a modest slowdown into a full-blown recession. Bad news for all of us, says fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart.
The US economy will always be vital to the global economy. After all, 20% of the global economy is down to the US consumer alone. And so the US economy is absolutely vital to the well-being elsewhere.
Today, the International Monetary Fund said that in the light of the subprime turmoil, it's revising its global growth forecasts downwards. It said the market turbulence is going to hit the real economy in many places, including Europe. But the worst affected country is likely to be the United States. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Whether you're ready for some football or not, the NFL season is upon us. Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts start their defense of their Super Bowl title against New Orleans tonight. Last week, Sports Illustrated ranked Manning as the best player in the league, number one out of more than 1,600 guys who play football for a living, which makes him a surefire top pick for the millions of fans playing fantasy football leagues. Diana Nyad's here to tell us about that. Hey, Diana.
Kai, how you doing?
I'm all right. Give me the 30-second version of what a fantasy league is.
Well, I guess it runs really parallel to what a real league is. There are real Joes out there in the world and Joannes who buy in to a league where they become the owners. Mm-hmm. So if you and I are two of the owners of a 10-league team, we have a draft. So if I go first, I get to pick any active player in the National Football League. So let's say I want Peyton Manning. Mm-hmm. He's my quarterback. So at the end of the week, I see how my guys did, and, you know, they score points by kicking field goals and throwing certain numbers of touchdowns, et cetera. We add them up at the end of the season, and if I'm the winning team, I win my Super Bowl, so to speak.
Right. If you're in it, you know it's huge, but I'm not in it. So tell me how big fantasy leagues are, specifically fantasy football.
It's bigger than huge. It's Leviathan. I mean, the reason statistics are, and according to commissioners, like there's a guy named Ed Fitzgerald, who by day is a senior manager at a biotech firm, by night and by weekend, he's the commissioner of a big league that's here in Los Angeles. He says that the 15 million people that are recorded as being owners and participating in fantasy leagues is way underestimated. He thinks it's up to about 30 million people. And $150 million, more or less, now coming in as revenue to just the magazines and the internet sites. Hmm. So that's not the sports bars. That's not the leagues themselves. That's not the cable and satellite packages that have blossomed and burgeoned just because of fantasy.
You know, this all started organically enough with some super fans 30 or 40 years ago, I guess it was. But my other guess would be that Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, and all the team owners who have hundreds of millions of dollars invested in their players are excited as you can be for more fantasy leagues to start out there because it just keeps bringing fans into their game.
Oh, it does. It multiplies the fan base exponentially. Now, the fantasy league guys and women, I shouldn't leave them out because that group is growing. It used to be zero. Now it's growing to about 11% of the fantasy leagues. The owners are women. Those people want to watch every game every week and follow every stat because every game has a meaning to them.
Not to be left out is the fact that we've been talking about revenue and hundreds of millions of dollars. All that revenue comes from the players. None of these leagues really, unless they're, I imagine, sort of friendlies among some buddies, are free. You have to pay to join.
You have to pay to join. Every league has a different set of rules. The league I was talking about here in L.A., run by Ed Fitzgerald, they have a particular set of rules whereby you pay to get in. You pay $50 to get in. That's not much. You pay $3 for every transaction. So at the end of the week, if I want to make a trade, if I want to make a cut, I got to pay $3. So all the owners paying that, it's not much money. At the end of the season, it's only going to be $500 to win. But it keep those little cha-chings keep people interested, you know?
The Business of Sports from Diana Nyad. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
Coming up, a college dream deferred.
I couldn't go, you know, the government asked me for more paper, something that I don't have right now.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 57 points, about 0.4%, to end at 13,363. The NASDAQ rose 8 points, about 0.3%, to close at 26,14. The S&P 500 rose 6 points, 0.4% there as well. 1478 is the number at the bell. Biotech company Biogen shares rose nearly 6% after it announced an earnings outlook that topped analysts' expectations. Merck's health improved to the tune of 2.1%. That after the New Jersey Supreme Court rejected a class action lawsuit against the drug maker over Vioxx. On the food front, General Mills is apparently eating its Wheaties. Its stock climbed 2.5% today. Bond prices fell. That bumped the yield on the 10-year T-note to 4.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity. And by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for August. Industry reps and analysts look down the road at trends and legislation in the generic drug market at the Generic Pharmaceuticals Policy Conference, wrapping up tomorrow. And rock musician Chrissy Hynde celebrates her birthday. The Pretenders band leader will be 56. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you happen to be one of those people who just can't get enough of the United States tax code, the House Ways and Means Committee was the place for you to be today. Chairman Charlie Rangel kicked off what he called the mother of all hearings, 4 days of discussion centered around the idea of tax fairness, things like the alternative minimum tax and whether or not to raise taxes on already rich private equity firms that go public to get richer, groups like Blackstone that raised $4 billion in its IPO. That raise would be a bad idea, says commentator Glenn Hubbard.
Congress placing a Blackstone tax on private equity firms seeking to go public calls to mind the alternative minimum tax. The dreaded AMT was put into effect so that a small group of very wealthy people paid a fair share of taxes, and it turned into a tax monster that now touches the lives of many more people than just the very rich. The Blackstone tax will also have its effects. For starters, it will give private equity giants like KKR cold feet. They've prospered without going public, and that means they're more likely now to stay private to preserve their wealth. That means ordinary investors like you and me won't be able to invest in the firms. Raising taxes still more also makes it harder for America's proportionately fewer public companies to compete head-to-head with global firms whose governments tax them at much lower levels. The question lawmakers ought to study is not whether Blackstone's investors should pay taxes twice, meaning pay taxes on both earnings and on shareholder dividends, but whether any investor should. This double taxation leaves America's corporate businesses the most highly taxed in the industrial world. And these high taxes are bad for investment, productivity, and wages. Congress did cut the tax on dividends and capital gains in 2003, increasing investment, stock prices, and dividend payouts. But that cut is set to expire in 2010. Interestingly, the Chinese government, looking forward, is investing $3 billion in Blackstone to access this piece of America's growth machine. Our own Congress, by contrast, has forgotten the slippery slope lesson of the AMT. In a terrible turn for tax policy, it's beginning a large tax increase on capital instead. And we'll pay the bill in decreased investing, lower market returns, and yes, lower wages.
Glenn Hubbard's the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to be the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. Your thoughts are always welcome. At our website is the best place to do that. It's marketplace.org. The pool of federal money that funds student aid programs is about to get $20 billion deeper. Last night, Congress agreed on a deal to cut subsidies to banks that issue those loans and use the money instead for aid programs directly. Today, the White House said the president will be signing that bill. We've been talking about education this week, about the accessibility of a college degree for people who might not ordinarily be able to get one. People like Reyes Ventura. From North Carolina Public Radio, Paul Quadros reports.
Reyes Ventura was once a star defender for his small-town high school soccer team in central North Carolina. The team won a state championship in 2004, the first predominantly Latino team to do so in that state. Members from that team still come together at a local park in Siler City on weekends to play. When Reyes graduated a year ago last June, he took a construction job along the coast. He'd drive up on the weekends to see his family and play pickup soccer before going back to work on Mondays. I drove down to the construction site one day in late summer and caught up with him there.
What time do you get into work today?
I come here every 6:30, which I work at 7. We get off 5:30 every day, 5 days a week.
Reyes moved to the coastal town of Wilmington 2 hours away to take this job because he wasn't making enough money at McDonald's. He was making $11 an hour as an electrician's helper, but he hated it and his boss.
He was yelling at me, telling me, yelling at me real hard, yelling at me all the time, go do this, go do that. And the first week I was, was going to quit.
He didn't quit, though. He needed the money, and so did his family. He sent money home to them twice a month. But this wasn't the life Reyes planned on after high school. He applied to two state universities and was accepted by both.
I couldn't go, the government asked me for more papers, something that I don't have right now, but I'm working on that right now.
Reyes is a legal resident of the United States. He has all the papers he needs to work, but he doesn't have what he needs to qualify for most financial aid.
I don't have the green card. That's what they want, the green card, to, so they can help me have financial aid.
Reyes may have to wait years for his green card to be processed. Not only would the green card qualify Reyes for state and federal financial aid, but it would also get him the much lower in-state college tuition rate. In the fall, about a month before Thanksgiving, Reyes invited me back to see where he was living and how he was doing.
Orange juice, lettuce to do my sandwich, eggs.
Tortillas?
Tortillas, yeah.
Reyes was living alone in a three-bedroom apartment provided by his company. It had five empty beds. The company laid off his roommates, all Latino workers.
It gets, boring, don't have nothing to do. Just come here home and just watch TV and maybe cook something and go to sleep and go to work next day.
This must get very, very lonely, though.
Yeah, real, real lonely. I don't have nobody to talk to,
The only thing Reyes said he had to look forward to every day was work. He was helping to build a 12-story office building that happened to be right next to Cape Fear Community College. He watched every day from above as the students walked to their classes, brightly colored backpacks slung over their shoulders.
I don't know what was I feeling when I saw the students, passing by with a book bag and go learn. I was kind of, sad. I don't know, like something inside me, like I say, I can be right there. I could be right there. But I watch where I'm at now, on the big building, working, and the students passing by.
Reyes could have been one of those students at Cape Fear. He was slowly giving up hope that he would ever go to school.
Sometimes I just, I say to myself, maybe college is not for me. Maybe I just go and work, and maybe my children, they will go have an education, a better life than me.
For a few more weeks after I saw him late that fall, Reyes kept working. Then he took a break to spend the Christmas holiday with his family. Being home made him realize how depressed and lonely he really was on the coast. It was just too far away. So he quit his job and moved back to take a job at a door manufacturing plant. He hopes he can save enough money to start taking a few classes at the local community college. His dream is still to go to law school someday. In Siler City, North Carolina, I'm Paul Quadros for Marketplace.
There's more on our education coverage, K-12 and beyond, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, nothing like a 6.5% drop in share price over 2 days to focus a CEO's mind. We told you yesterday the iPhone that used to cost $600 will now cost $400. Apple's Steve Jobs announced a $200 price cut as he rolled out some new iPods. It clearly wasn't what people who paid the $600 wanted to hear, though. Jobs posted an open letter on Apple's website today saying he's read every one of the hundreds of complaints the company's gotten, and he's going to give a little bit back. Not the full $200 difference, mind you, and not cash either. The company's going to offer a $100 credit usable at your local Apple store. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 57 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ rose 8 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 0.4% there. Our editors include John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, fanning the flames of Europe's monster truck fever.
These people do not know what they're getting ready to see. They have no idea. It's just going to be off the hook, man.
Who knew? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.